What I like to do every summer is sort of give us a bit of a sort of refresher what this Nexus project is all about. So that's what I thought I would do this morning. And then next week, I'm excited, we're going to talk more about our Nexus 2020 vision for the next year or so. And I want to introduce you to the people that we have hired for the positions that we have open here at Nexus. So that's what we're going to concentrate on next week. But again, for this morning, I just want to sort of take us through this Nexus thing. What is Nexus all about? So, excuse me, that's where we'll go. A few years back, I got one of my favorite emails ever because someone had emailed me and said, hey, I've been coming to Nexus on sunny mornings and I've been really enjoying it, but you haven't converted me just yet. And I love that. It made me laugh out loud. And I got together with this person, had coffee, and we were talking about this conversion thing. And she said, listen, I'm kind of interested. I enjoy sunny mornings, but I don't really want to be converted. I don't want to sort of be signed on the dotted line, so to speak. And so we got talking about that, and it really made me sort of think, what exactly is church about? Are we trying to convert people here at Nexus? And it's hard to ignore when you come as a church to Jesus' words in Matthew 28, his final words to his disciples. He says this, Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them everything I have commanded you. And these are Jesus' final words to his disciples, to his church. Jesus is sending the ones who have been following him out to make more followers. And the tradition through the church is that this task has been handed down generation over generation to the church. It's what we call evangelism. And so it seems hard to skirt around this idea that a church or any group of people who would sort of call themselves followers of Jesus would not sort of take this task seriously. And yet, let's be honest, this whole evangelism idea makes, I think, many of us really, really uncomfortable. It's kind of a bizarre thing, right? At least many of us have a history of that. I still remember the day when my dad came home and he had his bus license. He was so excited because growing up in our church, we had what we called the bus ministry. And that was that our church had anywhere from 12 to 15 buses. And they would go out Sunday morning just picking up kids. Got to bring the kids to church. And what that meant for me growing up is that every Saturday afternoon, I would go out with my dad and wait in the car. He would go to certain areas and just knock on their door as a stranger and say, hey, tomorrow I'm coming by with my bus and your kids are welcome to come on. We'll give them a chocolate bar and they can go to church. And that was a very boring way to spend Saturday afternoons growing up. And it's absolutely remarkable to me that parents allowed this. You're like, sure, that sounds like a good idea. Get on a bus with a stranger. And then that's what happened. Sunday mornings, I would get up with him, and I still remember those January, February mornings. Those are the worst. He'd be like, I'll get the bus started. You scrape off the outside of the bus, which they got like 40 windows, right? So it's just, oh, freezing. And we would go and pick up all these kids from neighborhoods and bring them to church. And there was always this weird sort of class distinction between these kids because they'd be wearing their PJs or track pants. And when we went to church as a kid, we all had to sort of dress up, tie every week. And so there was always like the bus kids, ooh, and us proper church people. And I don't know exactly what the mission was, but every week, hundreds of kids going to our church. And yet, once they were inside there, there was very much this us and them sort of mentality. And for me, it sort of always left this really bizarre, what were we trying to do that's so weird that our goal was just get kids on the bus, bring them to church. And I'm sure all of us have perhaps maybe our own stories of evangelism we've seen done really, really poorly or something that looked kind of icky and yucky. And so I think for a lot of us, because we've seen this evangelism thing done poorly, it's like blacklisted because I think the reality for many of us, the thought of evangelizing others, it seems like obnoxious or it seems so arrogant or manipulative, at the very least, like condescending. And I think that other people might need to believe what we believe just strikes us as so arrogant. especially when we live in a time of religious pluralism. Do we really think other people need to believe what we believe, or that what we believe is truer than what somebody else believes? But ultimately, I would say this, I think what it comes down to for me is, I don't know for certain if the Christian path is more true or better than, say, other religions. I don't know for certain if Jesus is the only way, or if Jesus' path leads to somewhere that other paths don't, or maybe somebody's going to hell. I have no idea, ultimately. And my guess is no one does. Faith is called faith for a reason. And yet, if you were to ask me, is Nexus trying to convert people, my answer would unequivocally be yes. And I think for some, that probably makes us go, oh boy, this maybe makes me uncomfortable. So that's where I want to jump in and simply try to answer a few fundamental questions. Why be Christian? Why Nexus? And who is Nexus for? And I want to dive into each of those three questions quickly. Why be Christian? Well, for me, it boils down to this. Here's the thing that I am convinced of. We all need a path to follow in life. And we can't travel every path in front of us. We have to choose one at some point. But we all need a path to follow. When I was going to ask Kristen to marry me, I decided that I would try to have some clever metaphorical thing going on. And so we used to hike a lot at Webster's Falls. And if you've ever been out there, beautiful area. There's Two's Falls, which is higher, beautiful, and then there's Webster's Falls. And the two falls in the area, they eventually come down and they meet at this specific point. And I thought, what a beautiful metaphor for marriage. And so I decided I was going to take her right to where the two rivers meet, and right there I would ask her to marry me, as in, our histories have been separate to different people, but today I want to ask you if you would marry me, and our rivers would join forever, so to speak. And it was all very romantic, I thought, anyway. And so that's what I did. She said yes, da-da-da-da-da. We've never been back to that place together, but a few years ago, I was hiking around Two's Falls, and right by Two's Falls, there's this rock outcrop that sort of juts out from the rest of the escarpment, and you can hike there. It's very narrow, about the size of this carpet, and it's basically sheer cliffs off either side, and you can look over to Two's Falls, and it's beautiful. It's very private. I like to go there and just think and ponder. And so I was sitting there a few years ago, and suddenly it dawned on me that the place I had asked Kristen to marry me was below me and somewhere downriver. I thought, I'd like to go there. I'd like to just revisit the past. And yet, I knew that if I hiked around and down the normal path to get there, it would take me about an hour and a half. So I thought, what if I just scaled down the cliff and then hiked to the point? That would be much quicker. I could probably get there in 20 minutes. And for some reason, this struck me as a good idea. And so I started making my way down the cliff face, and suddenly the ground just gave out on me. And I was sliding, and coming to a point where I thought, I'm just going to completely drop over something. And right at the last minute, while I was slipping on my back, I reached out and grabbed this little tree, just a wee little tree sticking out, and it held. Oh, I didn't die. And then I, from there, sort of shimmied my way down the rest of the cliff. And when I got there, I was completely engulfed in forest. I had no idea where I was. And so I tripped and stumbled around for about an hour, and I never found the place where the two rivers meet. I couldn't figure out where I was going. Eventually, it was starting to get dark. I had scrambled up, found my car, and took off, but I was completely lost. I had no idea where I was. What I needed was a path to follow. Because on my own, outside of a path, what I found is that I was just wandering aimlessly. I thought I could do it on my own. I thought I could navigate to this place, but what I really needed was the help and guidance of a path. I was sort of arrogant to think I could just make my way through the bush. And I think, for me, there's a parallel there in the spiritual life. My worry today is not that people would not become Christian, but that I think so many people today simply wander through life aimlessly, without ever really seriously thinking or considering, what direction do I want to take in life? What path do I want to follow? And I think we all have to wrestle with that question. What path are you following in life? What do you value? What is real? What does it mean to be human? What is needed to make this life, this world, all that it can be? And I think for many of us, we just wander aimlessly, head off into the woods without even considering the wisdom of following a path. And consider some of the research by a guy named Jan Sumis. Fascinating stuff. Imagine this for a moment. Imagine you are dropped off in a large forest on an overcast day so you can't see the sun. And you are told to head east in this forest. You have no navigational cues. There's no river. You're simply told to head east. Now, how far do you think you would make it east? The interesting thing is this. I think most of us think, well, I could probably stumble my way there. But there's a lot of wilderness lore and a lot of wilderness stories that seem to suggest humans sort of in the woods without navigational cues wander in circles. And the theory for the longest time, which I find quite funny, is that apparently for every human, one of our legs is slightly longer than the other. And so the theory was because of that, we would sort of over time wander around in circles. And it seems a bit silly to me, maybe, but the reality is there's so many accounts of people lost in the woods, they seem to wander in circles. And so researcher Jan Sumis decided, I want to do some research on this. And so over the years, he's performed numerous experiments to measure how humans travel without navigational cues. And what it does is this, is on overcast days, he'll ditch people into environments like, say, the Sahara Desert or thick forests, and then he straps a GPS to them and says simply to them, travel east. And what his research has found is absolutely mind-boggling to me. On the norm, without navigational cues, on average, no matter whether people traveled an hour or, say, 12 hours on foot, on average, people typically do not get farther than 100 meters from their starting point, regardless of how long they walk, an hour to 12 hours. Most people don't get farther than 100 meters. And I think there's a parallel here. I think this is true, equally true, on a spiritual level. There's wisdom in traveling on a path. And without navigational cues, I think we run the risk of spending our whole lives sort of wandering aimlessly, wandering in circles. And so when somebody says to me, why be Christian? My answer is simply this, because we all need a path to follow in life. We wander aimlessly without a path. We don't get very far. And so when it comes to Nexus, what I would say is this, we're simply calling people to a path. And again, I don't know for sure whether it's the best path or the only true path. I don't know. What I do know is we all need a path in life. And so why be Christian? Because we need a path to travel. Ernest Ingersoll once wrote this. Said, a trail is a happy promise to the anxious heart that you are going somewhere and are not aimlessly wandering around in a circle. One of my favorite books of the past 5 years or so, the book I stumbled on, it was in the bargain section at Chapters, and it was simply called On Trails by Robert Moore. And in it, he recounts his journey traveling the Appalachian Trail, but that's just one part of the book. The rest of it is a history and a psychology of trails and paths. And so he unpacks and examines the way animals travel by paths, all the way from ants up to elephants. And the book's intriguing, and it's basically a tribute to the wisdom of trails. And so he says this about how all throughout the animal kingdom, trails function as a form of external memory. So they follow them, trusting that the destination will be worthwhile. That's so key in my mind. Animals travel past because they know the destination will be worthwhile. There's a fascinating story from Botswana, a country in the southeast region of Africa, I believe it is. And in the animal kingdom, of course, migratory paths are essential. They're essential to keep you alive. They lead to water and food. And so trusted paths are basically the key to survival. But in 1968, Botswana put up a large wall, And prior to that, there was a large zebra migration throughout Botswana. But in 1968, the government erected 100 miles of wall that cut off this zebra migratory route, and it had a devastating effect on their population. But the interesting thing is this, the government tore down those walls in 2004. And when they did, the zebras returned to those migratory routes 36 years later, which is astounding because zebras only live to be about 12 years in the wild. And so they're trying to figure out, how did they know to follow these paths again? How did they, after three generations of zebras, how did they know to travel this path? And the leading theory is this, elephants. Elephants live to over 50 years old in the wild, and so is the theory is that as the wall came down, the elephants of Botswana remembered the migratory paths, where they went, and so as they began to make trails following the old paths, the zebras, recognizing the elephant's trail, just followed instinctively, knowing they would lead somewhere good. Paths are how we survive and thrive. To follow a trail is to work from the wisdom of the path, those who have come before us. It's to build upon the knowledge of those who have paved the way. And some of the words in his book strike me as so powerful, perfectly capture, I think, the immense wisdom of walking on a path. He says this, "It's impossible to fully appreciate the value of a trail until you have been forced to walk through the wilderness without one. A path is a way of making sense of the world. There are infinite ways to cross a landscape. The options are overwhelming and pitfalls abound. The function of a path is to reduce this teeming chaos into an intelligible line. Complete freedom, it turned out, is not what a trail offers. Quite the opposite. A trail is a tactful reduction of options. On a trail, to walk is to follow. Like prostration or apprenticeship, trail walking requires and instills a certain measure of humility. Both the religious path and the hiking path are made in the walking. Use creates trails. Long-lasting trails, then, must be of use." Next time you go hiking, remember those words. It's fascinating to walk on a physical trail and know that you've gone on a path that people have carved before you. And for me, those words also change how I see the Christian path as well. For me, this is here why we're calling people the Christian path, for all these reasons and more. You know, there's a great passage in Jeremiah that I love because of its trail imagery. In Jeremiah, Israel is pictured as they're trying to break out into the woods on their own, and it's left them in danger. And so the nation is about to come under siege from Babylon, and they won't listen to God. And God keeps telling them, return to the trusted path, but they're out in the woods on their own, so to speak. And God's saying to them, return to the path. They won't do it, and so he knows destruction is coming for them. This is what God says in Jeremiah 6:16 to them. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. We all need a path to travel. At Nexus, that path is the Christian one. And I know as soon as we start talking about paths and religion and whatnot, it's like, well, but what about other religions, other paths? How can I trust that this is the best one? How can I know? I'd say this, you can't. You can't travel every path. At some point, you have to choose one. And so when we talk about conversion, what am I trying to convert people to following a path? And at Nexus, it's the Christian path. I like how Robert Moore sums up his frustration with trail walking here, because it speaks to me too about, I think, a lot of times our frustrations and doubts about the Christian path. He says this, "You skirt down a ridge only to climb it again. You climb a steep peak when there's an obvious route around it. You cross the same stream three times in the course of an hour for no apparent reason, soaking your feet in the process. You do these things because someone, somewhere, decided that that's where the trail must go. Trail walking both requires and instills a certain measure of humility." And I love that image, that nature of a path. It's confusing. It can be frustrating. But as Moore reminds us, trail walking requires instills a certain measure of humility. And I think that's the way sometimes to approach our confusions or maybe frustrations with the Christian path. I don't get this. Yeah, but that's what trail walking is about. Sometimes it doesn't make sense. But there comes a point where you choose a trail. I don't know about you, but I struggle with FOMO, bad, fear of missing out. And have a very indecisive nature, which can be very problematic for me in the even in the most simplest of things. I find going out to eat at a restaurant a very anxiety-laden chore because I never know how to order off a menu. I'm always just like, oh, I feel like if I order this, I'm not, that could be really good too. And I find it so impossible to order that what I've done is I will ask everyone around the table what they're ordering and I'll order one of what they're ordering, which for some reason seems to bother people, and I don't understand why. Why do you care? But people don't like that. I order the same thing that they do, but I need something to reduce my options, and so instead of a whole menu, I've got maybe two or three dishes to pick from. And I find that much easier because my mind can constantly wonder, oh, I ordered the chicken, I should have got the steak. It's just difficult for me. But one of the things I'm realizing is you can't have it all. You have to choose at some point. We all will, in terms of life, consciously or unconsciously, but there comes a time to choose. This is the path I'm going to be intentional about following. And again, for me, for us here, that's simply the Christian path. And from what I can see, I think it's a good path, a trusted path. And I know some of us might say, but is it the only one? Again, I don't know, but I also think there's something about fidelity and loyalty and the language of devotion. And I think we see that a lot in Scripture, this language of devotion to the path. And I think there's something to that. I mean, when I think about my commitment to my wife, Kristen, I might say things about her like, she's the most beautiful woman in the world, or there could be nobody else for her, for me but her, or I might say that I'm completely devoted to her. And the thing is, that's not to mean that, you know, under tragic circumstances, perhaps I might not find someone else. No, but I think in any commitment, language should be a language of devotion. And so it is, I think, with Jesus in the Christian path. He's calling us to commit to his movement, to his path in life. And like any path, it's no good if once you're on it, you're constantly looking for a better one. At some point, there's a place to say, no, this is the path I'm on. This is the one I will choose. And so again, I would say this, at Nexus, I start with sort of an agnostic position. I don't know. I don't know anything for sure. But we've made a choice here. We're devoted to something we believe to be the best we know of, and at Nexus, we're committed to that path. But there's more to it than that, because it's not just about picking a path. It's about picking people to travel with. And so at Nexus, it's not just here, travel this path. Beyond that, it's calling people here to a specific company of travelers, you could say. A certain company of people to journey the path with. We're calling you at Nexus here to walk the Christian path with a certain group of travelers. This group, I have to say, it's a pretty good group of people. You know, it's interesting, this past summer, someone had asked me, just talk to me a little bit about the Nexus community. I described it a bit, and I said, you know, that it sounds like you're describing something very rare. It sounds like your community, at least maybe in the best of times, functions in some way like an extended family. And that's a lucky thing to have. And that's exactly how I sort of see this community, as an extended family, a group of sojourners traveling the same path together. And of course, like any extended family, some of us are a bit odd, have our idiosyncrasies, our quirks, and that can be interesting, but that's the nature of extended family. And it's, I think, the rarest thing in the world to have. And so at Nexus, it's a call to a path, a call to a community. Why choose Nexus? Because we all need a path. We need people to travel with. You say, but whoa, do I need to recruit others? Well, that's when it starts to get a little weird, right? Do I need to get others to join the path too? We get a little weirded out by that evangelism word, but I want to get one thing clear straight away. Everyone is an evangelist. And people seem to think that only certain kinds of Christians are evangelists, but I just don't believe that. I have yet to meet a person who's not an evangelist for something. Because evangelism simply means a proclamation of good news. And I don't know about you, but I found that humans always have lots of good news they want to share with people. It's amazing to me the things I've been tried to be converted to, even just amongst this community, whether it's a certain kind of music, a certain kind of lifestyle, hot yoga, essential oils, poetry, politics, veganism. I mean, there's so many things that people have tried to convert me to, because I think the thing is this, evangelism is simply this. In life, there are times when you go, I know I'm right about this, and other people need to hear about it. Or for others, it might simply be you have that moment of that thing that you've experienced that's so good, and you just have to tell others about it. It's crazy to me, people with their music and their books, right? Like, have you ever got into an argument about music? No, you must listen to this. They're so good. It can be often in vain, but it's hard for us sometimes to imagine that people can't understand what we see that's good about something. But the reality is this, I think, anyway, everyone's an evangelist for something. And we see it all the time. And so to me, it's not a question of, do we evangelize? Well, all of us do that in some capacity. I would simply say this, at Nexus, our good news is this, we have a good path to travel, and we've got a good group of people to travel with. That's what I'm trying to convert people to. And I think there's a big difference between that and saying, you know what, I'm right, I've got absolute truth, people need to agree with exactly what I think. I think that's vastly different than saying, listen, we got a good path, everyone needs to travel a path. We got a good group of people here, a great group of people to travel that path with. That's very different in my mind than saying, no, I'm right, and you need to change your mind. So who is Nexus for, then? Well, let's say, take a look at this passage. I'll try to summarize what I think Jesus is saying here. Jesus in Mark 2, he's talking with the Pharisees, of course, who are a bit of a foil in the Gospels, but he says to them, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've come not to call the righteous, but sinners. What is Jesus saying? I mean, he's speaking to the Pharisees, so I think he's being a bit sarcastic here. Sort of saying to the Pharisees, well, you've got it pretty figured out. Pharisees, you seem pretty healthy. You know, you've got the world sort of figured out in black and white. You know how the world works. So my movement's not for your type. Seems to be saying, no. What my movement is for, or who my movement is for, is people who are sick, people who struggle in life, people who find life difficult or complex or struggle with it. If you find yourself like me wandering in the woods trying to get to a place and you're feeling a bit lost sometimes, that's who my movement is for. We're looking for people to join us who don't have all of life figured out. And so somebody asked me, who is Nexus for? What I like to say is this. When I say this phrase, life is difficult, if you resonate with that phrase, the Nexus is a good place for you. Because I think that's at the heart of what Jesus is saying here. If you intuitively understand and feel life to be challenging, difficult, complex, even if it's only at times, then at Nexus, I think we have a path for you to follow, a community of people for you to travel with. And so for me, I'm not interested if an atheist, a Muslim, whatever, if a person tells me, listen, I feel great about life. I've got it pretty much figured out. I feel good. What do you need this for? Fair enough. That's not what this is for. What Nexus is for is, I think, people who understand life is a challenge. And life can be tricky to navigate. People who sense life is difficult. You say, well, good. Because we've got a path for you. And it's not an easy path, but it's a path. And we've got a community of people for you to travel with. And I think what happens is a lot of times some people think, well, my life's not that difficult. I mean, that sounds a bit overdramatic, Brad. My life's not that difficult. But I think we underestimate or play down sometimes our own struggles. This was brought home to me a few years ago. I made a very stupid mistake. I was talking to Sarah Holmes just directly after she had had Micah, her son, and we were chatting, you know, it came up, how was labor, and she said, oh, it was relatively quick, like it was only an hour of labor before I had Micah, and then I said something stupid. I said, "Wow, that must have been a dream." And yeah, the reaction on her face told me I had said something quite dumb, and I did. Because here's the thing, I know people who've been in labor for 12 hours, 24 hours. I know some people who were in labor for 36 hours. And I made the mistake of thinking, because others have suffered to this greater amount, that her experience of an hour in labor was trivial. When the reality is, for her, it was probably one of the most painful hours of her life. And I think this is our tendency in life. We mistake other people's difficulties in life, or even our own, as trivial. Well, it's not that. So many other people in the world have it way worse than I do. Fair enough. But just because some in the world might experience far greater difficulties doesn't mean we need to trivialize our own. And so I think for many of us, if we stop trying to compare ourselves and simply ask ourselves about life, if we're honest, we would probably say, yeah, this life thing's a bit difficult, and it can be a bit hard to navigate, and sometimes I feel a bit lost and in over my head, find the terrain of life hard to navigate. Well, then the message at Nexus is simple. We have a path here. This path doesn't make those difficulties go away, but there's a path here to travel, and we have a community of people to travel with. And so for me, that's kind of the heartbeat of Nexus. Life is difficult, it's hard to navigate, and so our calling is this. We believe everyone needs a path to follow in life. And the path we have chosen has been trailblazed by the person of Jesus, and that's what we're traveling, that's where we're following, that's where we're going. And everybody needs a path in life, so we want to invite you to the one that we're traveling. But more than that, we don't want to travel alone. We all need people to travel with. So we're calling you to community. So not only do we think we have a path, but we think we have a community here. And that's the invitation of Nexus. So, that's about all I got to say. But, normally we don't exactly have a lot of time. I thought I would see if we could do a little question response. If not, that's fine. But I wanted to give you a bit of an overview just of sort of what's the heartbeat of Nexus, what exactly are we doing here before we enter another season together and get lost in all sorts of hopefully fun and interesting things. What is it that drives this community? And for me, this is the driving impulse behind a community like Nexus. So hopefully it's a good refresher for us all. Anybody? We haven't done this in a while. Scott? Yeah. Yes. Yes.
If you describe ourselves as Christians and you look at Jesus, who's kind of like the whole object of the point of our faith, he says a lot of things that are fairly unequivocal as far as you know,
yep,
himself being,
yes, yes,
the only path, at least in this life.
Yep. Yeah. Right. A few things on that. I like to call my apologetic the weakest apologetic there is. Oh, I didn't. Of course. Sorry. How would I summarize that? Am I soft-pedaling the Christian faith a bit here by calling it a path, perhaps one of many, and that Jesus says a lot of things himself that seem unequivocal about how he is perhaps the only path? Decent enough summary? So my response was first, yes, I like to call my apologetic the weakest apologetic there is. Let me go on that for a second. What I have found with strong apologetics is they don't work. And so I'm not convinced a strong apologetic, and by apologetic I mean a defense of the faith, actually wins over a lot of people. And so for me growing up, there was always this point counterpoint. So a book would come out, Evidence for Faith, Josh McDowell or something, and it just seemed like this constant back and forth between sort of good Christian apologetics and atheists saying this, and it always, to me, sort of seemed a bit of a wash. But for me, I think this is the easiest way to start. And beyond that, to some of the things Jesus says, for instance, in John, I am the way, the truth, and the life. One of the things I mentioned here with the language of devotion is I think a lot of what we see in the Gospels is the language of devotion. And so I don't think it is, I would see it as, again, when you're committed to something, what sort of proclamations do you make about it? Beyond that, to sort of some of the questions around, is Jesus the only way? In my language of devotion, I could definitely say that. Jesus is the only way. But I think you can then sort of start to dribble down into, well, what does that mean? Can you find the way of Jesus through another religion? Again, this is where I don't know. And I'm not sure how fruitful it is to go down those paths. I don't know if you've ever seen this diagram. It drives me nuts, but there's an elephant and there's all these blind men touching different parts of it. And, you know, someone's like, well, this is a fan and this is a rope, you know, the guy holding on to the tail. And they're all describing the elephant in a different way. And the observer's kind of like, well, they're all describing a part of the elephant when what they're really touching is the whole elephant. All of them have a piece of it. Now, I can't stand that little cartoon because it assumes that there's an observer out there going, look at all you silly people describing part of the elephant when I can clearly see that all religions lead to the same place. I think that's equally as trite. So I'm not saying all religions lead to the same place. I just don't know. And I would say after the amount of years I've put into the Christian faith, and I'm still confused and overwhelmed by the richness of variety within the Christian faith. A friend of mine is applying to be a Quaker minister. And I'm like, Quaker? Like, geez, like I know so little about the Quaker tradition within Christianity. And so for me to say, not even knowing the breadth of the Christian tradition, to make some sort of pronouncement about another faith seems dangerous and would lead to oversimplification pretty quickly. So, I don't know if that answers your question at all, but that's sort of some ramblings anyway. Jake? Yep.
So there's many times that Christianity is built on Judaism.
Yep.
Islam is based on Judaism.
Yep.
And there's, you know, they, and that's, I think, from animism probably, you know, it's the idea that people are yearning for God, who created this, it's a natural question. And so I think there may be the same path many times we're converging on. Belief that you gotta do right and you gotta be good and you gotta, and God created the world and he's merciful and he's kind and he's just. They have all the same beliefs about the Creator.
A lot of things.
In some ways, Christianity has this fundamentalism. It's like, this is it, this is wrong. And it's not quite so simple. There's times we're wrong with some path.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That's how I
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I'm all wrong, but
Well, I think, converge is a path. And, a path is a metaphor, right? So every metaphor is going to sort of... Oh, you didn't hear the question? Yeah. Well, from now on, we'll have people try to speak up. You know what? I've got a mic back there, so we'll do that. Yeah, it's difficult when you start parsing a metaphor and its difficulties. It would say as you travel the Christian path, there might be some obstacles you come into, but I wouldn't want those obstacles to initially be a barrier to traveling the Christian path. It's a funny thing. I confess it's a weak apologetic, but I think there's a strength in it being weak. But wait 1 second, Peter. Hopefully, is this on, Kyle? Yeah.
Just two words. Why Jesus?
Why Jesus? For me or just in...
Well, I think for you.
Yep. Why Jesus? I don't know if I've ever encountered, and again, there's a lot mixed up here, the way it was brought up and whatnot, but I don't know if I've ever encountered such a compelling person who frustrates me, confounds me, inspires me. It's funny, I like to tell people, growing up, people would have life verses, right? And for me, my life, it's not a life verse, it's a life chapter. It's John chapter 6. And I love this passage because Jesus says, hey, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in the kingdom. And he's got a big following at the time, and everyone's like, what the heck is he talking about? And he has the chance to clear up the issue. Like, he could be like, guys, I'm speaking in metaphor here. But he doesn't. He sort of leaves it hanging there. And so everybody disappears and stops following him, except for the 12. And he says to them, are you going to leave too? And Peter's word said, I love it. Where else would I go? You have the words of eternal life. And to me, I find that passage so, it resonates with me so well, because there's parts where I'm like, I don't get this. And this is hard and difficult. And yet there's something so compelling about Jesus that I go, where else would I go? There's something so beautiful and big here. That I think that's the simplest way for me to say why Jesus. I don't know where else I would go. And there's something about that taste of life that I just can't deny my own personal experiences. I've talked in sermons before about how we have, perhaps some of us in our faith, have these shards of experiences that we just don't know what to do with. And I think I've got enough of those, plenty of those, that I'm like, I don't think I can walk away from this, even when it gets tough. So for me, there's just something so compelling and life-giving about Jesus that's why. Yeah, hold on, we got to do this, or Ian's going to put his hand up again so you can't hear it. No problem.
Just a very simple comment. When I think of strong apologetics, I think of that being very theologically based. Mm. And then it reminds me of a very strong leader, and people are simply following and sort of acquiescing to what a strong apologetic would want us to do. When I think of a weaker apologetics, and I think of sort of that analogy of the path, it seems so much more participatory to me, and I really appreciate that. I think that's one thing that I've really appreciated in Nexus, that invitation that we're all on this path together. So that's all.
Yeah, and I think there's something about, in my mind at least, about the barriers we construct. And so some of us have been brought up with the language, and I think for somebody outside the faith to be like, hey, here's the Christian path, and there's this Trinity thing you need to believe, and somebody coming back from the dead, and there's like this whole list, and it's kind of like, whoa. And I think for me, I'm like, can we start somewhere softer? There's a path for you to follow, and there's a compelling person that's blazed the trail. If if Jesus is compelling enough for you, whether you call yourself an atheist, agnostic, whatever, for you to simply be curious enough to explore, I want to say, you're in. That's part of, you're in. Let's go. Let's travel together. Yeah. Anyone else? Scott.
I think what I was really trying to ask by asking my question was really Peter's question, but Peter asked it much more succinctly and better than I did. So thank you, Peter.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I'm hoping that every season is a sort of 40-week-long answer to that question, but and even that feels weak, calling Jesus compelling. I think there's something more about it to that, but that I'm at a loss for words except to point to John 6, which again feels like a weak apologetic for why they're saying, they're like, I don't know where else I'd go. Jesus, you've got something going on that we can't walk away from, and that to me is, as of yet, there's something there. And we're going to spend the next 40 weeks diving more into that, which I'm excited about. Any other questions before we... Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, for me, why I like a weak apologetic is because I feel like it's inclusive of more people, and that's probably one of the big reasons why I come here to Nexus, is because I feel like there are just so many different types of people at Nexus, and I get from what I've seen and what I've heard from you that that's kind of the point of Nexus, and I appreciate that. That's why I'm here. So.
Awesome. Wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for the feedback, because I did this sermon or a version of it a couple years ago, and I wanted to come back to it because there's something I want to do something with this that takes it further, not in a season, but sort of outside of that. So I'm trying to work on this, and so I want all the questions and objections I can get, because I want to strengthen this idea, because I think there is something about a path and a community. Anyway, oh, yes. So I don't know why I keep turning this off.
I'm not sure this is a clearly formed question, but so I get everything you say.
Yeah.
But so what would you do for inviting people?
Yeah. What would I do for inviting people?
Or is that next week?
No. And I mean, geez. It's difficult. How would I say this? It's a weird position I'm in, because as soon as somebody figures out I'm a minister and they ask about that, Kristen's like, you should come to Nexus. And it's a bit of a weird thing that most of us don't have as our sort of job, like this, hey, you should come see what I do. How would I invite people? I mean, certainly, I think there's something about having a relationship with someone before. I don't know, like, I just did this summer a renewal marriage thing. It was their 10-year anniversary, and I did their whatever. It was a bit weird. But what's interesting to me is, as you get talking to me and to people and the questions that come up, to me, again, it's not about coming across as though we have answers, but saying, hey, I want to invite you on a journey, and I hope that our Sunday mornings, at least a lot of times, reflect that it's not come here so you will be told what and exactly how to believe, but it's again a participatory thing. You're invited on a path here. I don't know. I mean, there's so much baggage with inviting people to church and whatnot. I don't know exactly how to answer that, but I would hope that Nexus is or becomes enough of an integral part of people's lives as we journey in community, so that when, like any other piece of good news, like, hey, I saw this movie, you got to see it, kind of like, hey, part of my life is I'm a part of this community, and I think it's great, and hey, if you'd like to come check it out, for sure. But I don't know. Beyond that, that's kind of weak too. I don't know. Soup. Absolutely. Soup is good. Absolutely. We got to, it'll be a little while before we do soup again, but soon enough. People like food. I like food. And there's something in my mind mystical about sort of eating together that, anyway, that's a whole other thing. I'm going to close in prayer, but while I have you here for these group of people, this fall's a little season 10, I'm calling it the curiosities, and I've got lots of fun things, I think, planned. September's a little confusing because we're here for the first 2 weeks, September 8th and 15th. And then we're going to be somewhere else because this building is rented out for the next 2 weeks. So we're going to be at a mystery location. We'll have that. I'll let you know next week where we're going to be. But it could be a bit, could be hard to find us. But I want to get the word out now because I know the way things go and people will end up here and we're somewhere else. So for 2 weeks in the last two Sundays of September, we're going to be at another building, a mystery location, which will be revealed next week. The thrill of it all. Next week we're going to talk about what I like to call the sexiness of organization, which, pray for me, that's going to be a feat. But I'm going to talk about that, and then we're having another pool party at the Benjamins on September 1st, and then we'll jump into season 10.